This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices, united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
Welcome, everybody, to a Monday edition of the OBP, the Orange Bloods podcast. The first podcast I've done post-spring game. Apologies for that. I was going to do something on Saturday night, and man, I got like a 101 temperature in the middle of the game, started sweating, and just it wasn't good. I got my article done on orangebloods.com, and I was like, sorry, Yak, but tonight I've got to put my head on a pillow and get through this thing. And then yesterday I woke up, and I was all in on Liverpool soccer. The Masters was going on. I had my 10 thoughts from the weekend, and the podcast just didn't get done. So apologies that this post-spring game podcast didn't get done. I don't know, like 24 hours earlier, maybe 36 hours earlier. But the content post-spring game here on the Yak for myself and Anwar Richardson and Dustin McComas and everybody else in the Orange Bloods gang will, I think, be significant enough that you guys maybe will cut me some slack for whatever that weird thing was. I think I just had a bad meal or something. It wasn't the highlight of my month so far. But what a weekend. What a weekend. I'm going to get to Tiger. We're going to talk about Tiger. I'll talk about some other things from the weekend. That is, if I don't go on a 45-minute spiel on the spring game that would have me looking at the clock and realizing, okay, maybe this is just a spring football podcast. So we'll see. I've got lots of spring football stuff in my head, but man, it was, I don't know how to describe it. Like, look, the Tiger Woods thing. Oh, here I go. I'm going down a dissertation before I get to the spring football stuff. It was just a weekend that I think we'll remember for the rest of the year. We all knew that the start of Game of Thrones, for those of us that watch Game of Thrones, was just a marker moment in 2019. But to have Tiger Woods steal all of the attention away from Game of Thrones, at least until Game of Thrones came on, it'll be, you know, I think we're going to talk about the Tiger Woods win at the Masters forever. That is a generational story. I think that's the story that we're going to remember Tiger Woods for forever. That's the number one thing. And people might say, that's crazy. And because look, Tiger's had so many moments. But when we think about Jack Nicklaus, I feel like the 86 Masters is the first one that comes to mind. And I think that the sight of Tiger holding his kids yesterday, it got me. Oh, you know, maybe it's just because I'm a dad now, but knowing that, you know, his father wasn't there, knowing that I've never seen Tiger hug his kid like that before. It was a moment. And like I said, I think it was a transcendent one. I think that we watched history yesterday, and I don't even know that we truly know that the impact of that moment. But my sneaking suspicion is that it will be one for all time. The spring game on the other on the other side of the equation wasn't. Typically, I think everybody that would listen to a premium podcast about Longhorn football, they probably have the spring game on their DVR. I've watched it once since the game ended. So I've now watched the spring game twice. I don't know that I need a third time. It was not for all time. It was not for all time or even close to it. I thought about making a post on Saturday afternoon. I was driving my car down the highway. I think I was going to the bank and just going to make a deposit before 2 o'clock. And I'm on the toll road. Sorry, for whatever reason, the words toll were escaping my brain there. I'm on the toll road and my car is just blowing all over the road. It was really uncomfortable. It was one of those moments where I was kind of glad that if I was on a highway, at least I was on the toll road, because it felt like my car was getting pushed all over the place because of the wind. And I just don't remember driving that often where the wind had been so powerful that I just didn't feel like I almost had control of the car. This is about 2:30. No, maybe it's about 1:30 because clearly the bank's closed at 2 and I was on my way to the bank. So it's about 1:30 and I just remember thinking to myself, man, if the wind is going to be like this tonight, then the passing game's just going to be worthless. And I thought about making that post, thought about making that tweet, ended up not making it because how sexy are wind posts and wind tweets? It was something that I thought, but I was driving, and by the time I wasn't driving and I was in front of a computer, I just didn't do the wind thing again. But you could make a strong case that the MVP of the spring game was the wind. And it really did make that thing on Saturday an event where it was hard to get a lot out of it, because when the offensive side of the football can't really engage in half of what it does, it just wasn't that big of a deal. It's not a big deal anyway, but you know, it's still game atmosphere. You're in the stadium. There's a bigger crowd. It's bigger than a usual practice. I just think that, you know, there just wasn't much to take from it in terms of on the offensive side of things. Like, we know what Sam Ehlinger is. Colin Johnson didn't play, but we know what he is. I thought that as putrid as the offense was, and I think we'll go position by position through this in a little bit. You know, I thought that we were able to see a few things from the offense that would make you feel optimistic. But I think all in all, we know that that side of the ball is going to be pretty good this year. I guess maybe the question comes down to whether or not we think that side of the ball is going to be very good, good, great, better than great. I mean, that's probably the million-dollar question on that side of the ball. On the defensive side of things, I thought there was a lot to feel good about and maybe just a little bit concerning. But considering that we did the Ticket City podcast 2 days before the spring game, and the theme of that podcast was, okay, what would create a meltdown on orangebloods.com? What could possibly happen in the spring game, if anything, that would create a meltdown? And there were suspicions. Well, look, the offense has been better than the defense for much of the spring. And Tom Herman's kind of indicated that he wants those defensive guys to respond better. And what happens if they go out in front of the stadium and Sam Ehlinger just lights them up? There's a whole bunch of offensive points. And what happens if the questions about this defense feel reinforced after watching the spring game? That's what we talked about, but that's not what happened. By and large, the defense dominated the spring game. And again, it comes with an asterisk, but it did dominate the spring game. They made Sam Ehlinger on Saturday, along with the MVP of the game, the wind, they made Sam look like a guy that hadn't won the starting job yet. And that throw that Jeffrey McCulloch intercepts, that was not Sam's best moment, wind or no wind. So the defense, I thought, did some really good things. And I think that if we're talking about a spring game review, I think you start with the defense, and I think there are more positives than there are negatives. And let's start with the positives. Let's start on the defensive side of the ball. I feel like we always go offense first. But on a night where the offense was muted, we probably should start with the defense. And I think the top two names from the spring game that jump out to me, especially after watching it a second time, I thought Jeffrey McCulloch was the MVP of the game, not named the wind. Upon the rewatch, Jalen Green was really, really, really good. And I really wanted to see more of Jalen Green a year ago. I thought he was a player that probably his talent warranted more reps than he received. But I get it. You know, they had senior cornerbacks, and they trusted Devontae Davis and Chris Boyd more than they trusted Jalen Green. But my goodness, you can just see future Sunday player written all over that kid. And he flashed time and time again in the spring game in a way that's just really, really exciting. So Jalen Green and Jeffrey McCulloch were the two players that really stood out for me. And Jeffrey McCulloch is a guy, and I wrote about this in my 10 thoughts from the weekend over at orangebloods.com, but McCulloch we've been waiting for the light switch to flip on with that kid for a while. He's a senior now. And from the moment that he arrived on campus, there's been this internal feeling inside the program that they've got something special with this kid, that the talent is there. It's just a matter of putting it all together, and it hasn't happened. Now, there were moments last year where McCulloch would flash in ways that would make you go, there it is! There it is! That's it! Do that! Do that every play! You can do that every play! Do that every play, and you're a star. But McCulloch would do it like once or twice a game, if that. And he was solid. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to paint the picture of Jeffrey McCulloch not being good, because I thought he was good a year ago. The expectations, though, have always been that at some point he would become next level. A guy that's, forget about All-American, just all Big 12, just that good. That he would be at least that good. And he hasn't been that good. The player we saw on Saturday and the guy that we've been hearing whispers about throughout the spring, that guy looked that good on Saturday. And given that Texas has high turnover at the linebacker position right now, it was a big, big deal. I came out of the spring game. You know that Texas isn't going to play a traditional 4-3 very often. They'll probably do it against LSU, because LSU will probably just try to line up on some level and see if they can mash Texas's mouth. I don't think they want that game to be a big, they want that game to be a traditional SEC style game. They don't want a Big 12 game to break out at DKR, because that's advantage Texas. But outside of rare situations, Texas won't be in a 4-3 very often. They'll be in nickel. They'll be in dime. When they're on nickel and they've got two linebackers on the field at the same time, I think on Saturday, we saw the combination of Joseph Asai and Jeffrey McCulloch together. To me, that looked good. To me, they were all over the field. I thought McCulloch was sideline to sideline. He was in pass defense. He just did everything. Osai's a little bit of a different guy in that environment when you can't really rush the passer and get him moving forward. You know, he's got a little bit of that Sergio Kendall thing going where I don't know that you're going to ask him as a thoroughbred to run backwards. And the Texas coaches will have an abundance of options to mix and match inside of that nickel and that dime. But in a traditional, 3-2, sometimes you'll see a 3-3 with that overhang. So sometimes when they're in nickel, obviously you'll see three linebackers. But I think this is going to be a season where they play with a lot of two. But, I think they've got options now. I think that, the involvement of of those two players, I think, will allow Texas to be as versatile on that side of the ball as they've been probably since Todd Orlando arrived. Now, that means Osai and McCulloch have to bottle up what they've flashed. And it's not a given. I can't automatically just say it's absolutely going to happen, because the spring game is only the spring game. But I don't know that you could ask for more. And I thought that Jeffrey McCulloch's performance was key. I thought Jalen Green's performance was key, because that guy looked like an improvement over what Texas had at cornerback a season ago. And I think that it's the type of improvement that some people have taken for granted. They've just assumed it's going to happen. I've been a little bit cooler on that, and that these guys have to grow up on the field a little bit, and it didn't just add water, instant all Big 12 level player. But what we saw of Jalen Green on Saturday, I think, is enough to give people reason for hope that this will be a Texas defense that has a better number one level corner. And look, you've still got Anthony Cook. You've still got, this was a secondary missing pieces inside of it that I don't want to say the backup guys, but in terms of when we think of who the A-list guys in the secondary are, I don't know that Texas had many of them on the field on Saturday, and yet Jalen Green was the type of guy that I think you walk away from that practice saying, okay, well, he's A-list now. He's never played in a game, but I'll put Jalen Green on the A-list, which is when you think about it, pretty heavy praise for a kid that's not started a game, just seen a little bit of playing time. Meanwhile, that secondary, when you look at what that 2018 recruiting class, you know, usually this is the way I think about it with recruiting. If you sign 4 4-star guys, you know, the hope is that half of those guys pan out in big ways. You're never going to, if you sign 10 4-star guys, you know, the hope is that 3 or 4 of them or 5 turn into starting level players, but rarely are you going to hit at a higher rate than that. Like hitting 5 out of 10 is really good, actually. You know, the 2002 recruiting class is generally thought of as one of the best, maybe probably the best recruiting class along with the 2005. The best recruiting class of all time. But you go back and look at that 2002 class and there are just as many misses as there are hits. But that's why recruiting at a super high level matters, because when you recruit a ton of elite prospects, you can afford misses. You can afford an injury or two. You can afford grade issues. You can afford a guy getting homesick or whatever the case may be. You can get over that. What's really interesting to me about this 2018 defensive back class is that they've only been on campus, some of them less than 12 months. Some of them have been on campus for about 14 months. But these are second-year players who, well, look, when Michael Huff and Cedric Griffin and, you know, Kendall Briles and Aaron Ross and Terrell Brown, when all those guys were coming through, they weren't this good this early. You know, these guys are, in the case of Caden Stearns and B.J. Foster, they were impact players as true freshmen. None of those guys did that. Nate Vasher wasn't impact right away like that. None of those guys were. Most of them redshirted, and it took a season or two. I can remember Texas fans hating Cedric Griffin for that play he made in the Oklahoma game, or play he didn't make in the Oklahoma game, where he was along the sidelines and just kind of gave up on a play, and the Oklahoma wide receiver ran back inside the field instead of going out of bounds, gained about 15, 20 more yards, and everybody thought of Cedric Griffin as a quitter. Not the guy who was a starter on the national championship game. Not the guy who detonated the tight end Hartsock from Ohio State in that game in Columbus. All they associated with him was quitting on that play in the Oklahoma game. In a game where Texas lost by like 147 points, he became a bit of the scapegoat. So these guys that are all-time great just weren't as good as these guys in the 2018 class have been. And the thing about that 2018 group is that I don't see a bust in the group. Caden Stearns, hit. B.J. Foster, hit. Jalen Green, hit. Deshaun Jameson, Anthony Cook, looks like he's going to be a hit. DeMarvion Overshown is a guy they're just dying to get on the field. Looks like he's going to be a hit. Deshaun Jameson, I guess, would be the last guy in that group at this point? In the pecking order? Maybe not. He's just the last guy that I'm talking about in this side of the conversation. Everybody thinks he's sensational. He played as a true freshman on offense, and now he's on defense because they think that's his best side of the ball. Every single guy they signed looks like he's going to pan out, and not just pan out. Most of them look like they're going to be surefire NFL players. It is, you know, when I come out of the spring, I think the single biggest thought that I have is that this secondary has a chance to be special. And they have a chance to be special for 2 more years. You know, one of the big regrets about Earl Thomas and his career was Texas redshirted him in 2007. They only got 2 years out of him. He's the best defensive back in the history of the program. He's going to be an NFL Hall of Famer. He was the MVP of that 2009 team. And you wonder, if he played in 2007, with how much would that have changed that season? And how much better would it have made him in 2008? Because in 2009, he was probably the best defensive back in any single season I've ever seen. He was better than Michael Huff was in 2005, and Michael Huff was Hall of Fame good. He was, one day, Michael Huff should be in the College Football Hall of Fame, and it should be because of that 2005 season, and Earl Thomas was better in 2009. The next 2 seasons, which line up perfectly with Sam Ehlinger being the quarterback in this program, the Longhorns have a chance to be as good as anybody in the country in the secondary. And anybody in the country in the secondary in the Big 12, that's important. Now, think about the linebacker position. Suddenly that looks a little bit better. The depth is a concern. Depth is a big concern, but at the very top, with what Texas has, and then just with the athleticism and talent they have behind them, you wouldn't necessarily lean on it. Think about if you spun a guy like Overshown down to linebacker in a dime package. You're getting him on the field. Technically, he's still a defensive back, but in a dime package or even in a nickel package, you could use him to in a bit of a downhill linebacker kind of a way. So they've got options. I think the linebacker is going to be fine. I watched enough of Keandre Coburn on Saturday to think that that guy is going to be really good in time. Is he all Big 12 this season? Maybe not. But I think the combination of him and Gerald Wilbon at defensive tackle, Texas will be good. Texas will be at least as good. They'll be better this year inside than they were last year. Like, I think Gerald Wilbon as a senior and Keandre Coburn as a redshirt freshman together, I would take that group and its upside over Chris Nelson a season ago with Gerald Wilbon as a junior. Now, I might end up being wrong on that, but I'll take Coburn's upside. For me, Coburn has a chance to be a massive disruptor. It's only about how many plays per game he can get. I think there's some thought right now that you're going to get about 30 snaps a game out of him, and it's not as many as you would like for a guy that has a chance to be that impactful, but maybe that's what Texas is going to get, and if you're going to get 30 good snaps out of Keandre Coburn, maybe at this point you only can give him 30 snaps. Maybe if you're giving him 40 snaps, maybe at that point you're only getting 25, 30 good snaps. And then there's 10 that you'd rather have Gerald Wilbon on the field or someone in that rotation. But I like what's going to happen. I think the defensive tackle is going to be fine. My question mark for this defense, and it's a big one, I don't know where the pass rush comes from. I still don't know about Taquan Graham and Malcolm Roach as hand-on-the-ground starters on this defense. I think Texas right now, until proven otherwise, is very average at their defensive end spots. They had trouble a year ago getting a pass rush without having to blitz. And that was with Charles Omenihue on the team, one of the best pass rushers in the Big 12. But it was pretty much Omenihue and very little else consistently in that area. He's gone. Brecken Hager's gone. I don't know what Taquan Graham and Malcolm Roach are going to do. Someone wrote in my 10 Thoughts from the Weekend thread over on Orange Bowl, it's like, hey, I thought they did well defending the run. Well, everybody did well defending the run the other night. Like, the defense did a good job in general against that. But there wasn't a real pass rush. There wasn't, those guys just are not yet jumping off the screen in a pass rush capacity. And I think that, if you ask me today where Texas gets its pass rush, I think that they're going to have to blitz. And Todd Orlando showed, look, he's not afraid to do that. He's not afraid to bring B.J. Foster. He's not afraid to bring Anthony Cook. He's not afraid to bring anybody. He'll blitz anybody and everybody. But when you have to bring extra pressure to bring pressure, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. And you open yourself up for more potential problems. And I don't know that Texas is going to be able to get there very often this season by rushing four. Or definitely three. I don't see three-man fronts with a Wilbon, Roach, Graham three-man line, to me, gets you no pass rush right now. I still need to see Malcolm Roach thrive with his hand on the ground in a three-man look. That his success since Todd Orlando has arrived has been minimal, but when it's happened, it has not always been with his hand on the ground. And Taquan Graham was a non-factor in terms of major disruption last season. So, you know, the coaches are building those guys up and talking about them in ways that would lead you to believe that the coaches believe they're going to be more than fine. Maybe they will be. I just haven't seen it yet. And until I do, that's the question mark for me. And it wasn't something that I thought was solved on Saturday. Over on the offensive side of the ball, look, what do you want me to say about Sam Ehlinger? It was just one of them days. He wasn't very good, but the circumstances kind of created it. And like, I think he's earned the benefit of the doubt. It was just one. I won't think about the spring game performance again, probably beyond this week. Casey Thompson, I thought Casey threw the ball better than Sam did, although it should be said, Sam threw a couple of dimes on Saturday that his receivers just didn't help him out on. Jordan Whittington's got to catch that ball in the end zone. You're going to run the wheel route, and Ehlinger's going to put the ball perfectly the way that he did in a place where the defender can't even look at it. You just have to catch that ball. Whittington didn't. You know, Sam's a couple of catches away of really nice passes from looking like Sam. They didn't go down, so in the end, you know, kind of out of sight, out of mind. I thought Casey Thompson, though, delivered some nice balls. I thought he threw the ball okay. His yards per attempt was under 2 in the first half. So, you know, he couldn't have been that okay, but he was okay. And I thought he showed enough in the run game that, quite frankly, I started thinking about in the middle of the spring game, maybe Casey Thompson needs to play a lot next year in, you know, not against Oklahoma, not against LSU, but when they play Louisiana Tech, you know, maybe mix instead of having, I don't know, Sam Ehlinger run the ball 15 times in that game. You know, maybe you're going Wildcat, maybe you're going Wildcat with Jordan Whittington too, but maybe you're doing some run game packages that don't ask Sam Ehlinger to give up a pound of flesh every week. Because that is the other thing about this team, that the elephant in the room is, they're only going to go as far as Sam Ehlinger takes them, and Texas has to find a way to keep Sam Ehlinger on the field for every game this season. It's hard, though, because what Sam's at his best when he's lowering his shoulder and trying to plow over people, but he also exposes himself in those same situations. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. I think Texas would be smart to look, okay, well, look, in Casey Thompson, they've got a guy who can give Texas more in the run game from the quarterback position than Ehlinger. Now, of course, when he comes on the field, he can't do anything in the passing game, so it becomes a little bit more of an obvious run game situation. And so, again, there's a couple of damned if you do, damned if you don't situations. But, you know, in situations where you absolutely know that the run is coming, be damned. And you're going to be in that kind of, you know, wildcat run game heavy formation. I think I saw enough on Saturday from Thompson and Whittington to think, okay, well, they should go out of their way to take that off of Sam's load, because they've got guys that can improve on that. No offense to Sam, but those guys give you a little bit more juice, a little bit more something. And I don't know, if I'm the Texas coaches, I have to tap into that very early into the season, all season long. I thought the running game, I don't know why everybody's tripping about the running back position. I think a little bit like I think about the defensive tackle situation, give me a freshman version of Jordan Whittington and a sophomore version of Keontae Ingram, and I'll take that over a freshman edition of Keontae Ingram and a senior version of Trey Watson. No offense to Trey Watson. But even in small doses, Jordan Whittington showed you on Saturday that he's a guy that when he touches the ball can give you explosive plays. Throw him a ball, throw a little swing route out to him out of the backfield, and he might take that 30 yards instead of 5 yards. You know, and I always felt like Trey Watson was the kind of guy who, if on 3rd and 5 you needed 5 yards, Trey Watson could get you 5 yards. If it was 3rd and 15 and you threw the ball to Trey Watson, I kind of felt like he's the kind of guy that would get you 5 yards. So I like this running back rotation, this grouping. I think, you know, I think the interesting thing about the spring game is it seems pretty obvious that Kirk Johnson is the 3rd running back and that Daniel Young is the 4th running back. And I'm fascinated to think what Daniel Young thinks about that. But he's gone from at the end of his freshman season seeming like a guy who could be the future. I don't know what to tell Daniel Young. He's behind Kirk Johnson, who's okay. Good for Kirk Johnson. Kirk Johnson looked like a guy that would actually play some next season based on the volume and the usage and the fact that they can't just play two running backs next year. So, I don't know. I'm not worried about the running back position for Texas. I'm not worried about the wide receiver position, clearly. I thought the tight ends, I don't know how much to judge. I know there's a, look, there were too many drops. I think that we know that Jared Wiley will be a guy that over time, the coaches think he has a chance to be a star. He's not there yet. I think we know that Cade Brewer is a guy they have big expectations for this season. I wasn't really impressed. It's a team that still looks like they're losing and missing Andrew Beck. But, you know, I think that's the only side of the ball where I have real starting question concerns. I look at the offensive line, and Parker Braun will mean so much. His presence, just from a starting offensive line standpoint, I think will make that line good. The best that Texas has had in over a decade. Depth continues to be a question mark. It's a question mark for pretty much every school in the country, including Alabama. Even Alabama's walking around today talking about their offensive line depth. Everybody has that concern. Oklahoma has that concern. You could probably count on one hand the number of programs in all of college football right now that are really, really good on the first team offensive line and then actually have a second string offensive line that they feel good enough about that they could play the majority of them in the games and not blink an eye. And Texas doesn't have that, but most people don't have that. I think we have to keep some perspective when we say, oh man, they're an injury away. Man, everybody in college football in the offensive line is an injury away. They just are. If Sam Cosmi gets hurt, yeah. Yeah, no. If you go to any offensive line in the country and you take away their best offensive lineman, and that, especially if that best offensive lineman is your left tackle, yep, problem. So, I don't know. I'm pretty I'm more bullish on this team coming out of the spring than I would have thought. I like the fact that I think this team just has young talent everywhere, and I think we saw that in the spring game. Couple of other thoughts, spring game related. The Ludacris concert, I didn't go, but everything that I've seen, that looked like that was fun. That looked like that was a success. As Anwar pointed out to us in our Slack conversation with the Orange Bloods group yesterday, kind of conspicuous that Luda didn't tweet anything about it. No social media mentions of him having been on campus and doing the hook 'em and all of that stuff, but it looked like it was a success. I thought the spring game in general, I thought given the circumstances of the weather and everything else, it was all right. It was all right. You know, I think it's interesting that Oklahoma spring game played the Friday night. I think they probably had a bigger crowd. They didn't have the wind issue. So the headline coming out of the Oklahoma game, from what I could tell, was Jalen Hurts, really good. I think he was 11 of 14 for a 190. I think. I may have just made those stats up. Out of thin air, but I'm pretty sure that's what I read. The offensive line in Oklahoma, that was a question mark. Weirdly, Oklahoma sites and news outlets were reporting that the pass defense was really good. I just don't know how the pass defense could be really good if Jalen Hurts was lighting them up for 11 of 14 for 190. So maybe the pass defense was really good against the second string offense, of which I don't know what to make out of that. It's like, what would I make out of the first string defense against Casey Thompson? Like, how do I judge Thompson? How do I judge what the secondary is doing? Because Thompson's not at a level yet that you should be gauging your secondary against. So look, I come out of the spring game thinking the Big 12 title, it's Big 12 title or bust for this Texas team. If I'm thinking about Texas again, I know what Vegas has as a line on that game at this point. I think what Oklahoma has a 2-touchdown favorite. I think that's a pick'em game. And if I had to bet a mortgage payment today on that game, I would put my mortgage payment on Texas. It's Big 12 title or bust. After eyeballing them in the spring game, I don't know how you get away from that. Now, back to Tiger for just a second. back to Tiger. I think one of the things about Tiger that's really interesting for me is, I don't know. It's, first of all, Tiger and I are basically the same age. I think we were born a month apart. I think he's, if I remember correctly, maybe he's a May baby. Maybe we're not even a month apart, but we're contemporaries in terms of age. And so, you know, when Tiger was 18, I was 18. And when Tiger was 25, I was 25. And when Tiger was 30, and I was, you know, like when Tiger was at that age where he was doing crazy stuff, I remember thinking to myself, well, I'm at that age and I'm doing crazy stuff. I'm just not married. But I feel like over the years I've been able to, I don't want to say identify with Tiger because I ain't Tiger Woods, but when you're the same age, you go through things sometimes the same. You know, as Tiger has entered his 40s and felt vulnerable enough that he didn't think he was ever going to be back. He was telling people inside of golf, and he's freely admitted this over the weekend, he thought he was done. So you can look back and try to find gotcha moments for reporters who said that Tiger was never going to win again. But Tiger said that. How much grief can you give a reporter for saying that Tiger Woods would never win another major when Tiger Woods was walking around telling people, man, I ain't never going to win another major. So here we are this weekend, and we've seen Tiger just strip down, man. We've seen, it's been 11 long, almost 11 long years since he's won a major. The last time he won a major, Barack Obama hadn't yet been elected president. The financial crisis of 2008 really hadn't, like, been hammered home yet. Lehman Brothers hadn't crashed. Uber wasn't a thing yet. Facebook was just taking off in terms of possibility. I think I was on a MySpace page back the last time that Tiger Woods won a major. And I wrote about this over at orangebloods.com. It was so long ago that I'll never forget him winning the U.S. Open on that play, in the playoff on the Monday, because I had just started doing radio with Chad Hastings. It's so long ago that that was early in my radio career, and all I did was a decade of radio after that U.S. Open before deciding I don't want to do radio anymore. So it's almost a lifetime ago for those of us who are sports fans. 2008's a lifetime ago. Texas OU in 2008 hadn't even been played yet, let alone Colt McCoy and the game against Alabama, let alone the last decade of UT football. It feels like a lifetime ago. I wasn't married. I didn't have kids. And Tiger was married, but Tiger didn't really have kids old enough to appreciate what he was in the golf game. And so he never had that moment. You know, it's what we think about with Phil Mickelson. We think about Phil winning the Masters for the first time and hugging on his daughters. We never had that moment with Tiger Woods yesterday. And that we did, it made Tiger feel more like us, normal people. All we've ever done is look at Tiger Woods as he's the most unlike us golfer that's ever lived. I mean, the fact that he married like some Swedish, I guess she was a nanny. I was going to say she was a supermodel. She could have been a supermodel, but she was just a nanny. Maybe a nanny for a supermodel. I don't remember. All I know is that Tiger Woods is the most unlike us golfer probably of all time. You know, and that yesterday he felt totally relatable to. I know people. Look, my wife isn't a Tiger Woods fan. She doesn't give a shit. I honestly don't even know her full opinion on Tiger Woods. We've just never had a reason to really talk about it. Like, honey, now that time has passed, what do you think about Tiger? Like, we just haven't had that conversation. But they were showing the replay of the golf tournament on CBS late yesterday afternoon. And I was like, hey, babe, come here. You got to see this. You got to see this because this is history. This is a generational event. This will be the thing that people talk about with Tiger Woods forever moving forward. So I queued it up right to the part where he taps in to win the Masters, and she's watching, and I'm like, oh, I hope you're not bored by this, and it's taking a while, and he's doing the fist pumps, and you've seen that before. By the time the scene where he hugs his son and his daughter are over, I look over, like, my wife's eyes are tearing up. Like, it's what yesterday was. Relatable. Hugging your kids in the moment of your greatest triumph, sharing that with them, sharing that with his mom, it just was perfect. We deserve that. We deserve that moment as sports fans. Thank God we got it. It was awesome. It was awesome. For everybody who's been hoping and a winging of a prayer that Tiger would one day have that moment, for him to have it after everything that's happened. It was just, it was a really, really, really special moment. And I just wanted to point that out again. Real quick, some thoughts on Game of Thrones. If you are not a Game of Thrones watcher, you can stop listening. If you are a Game of Thrones viewer, but for some reason you haven't watched episode one from, like, if for some reason you could be a Game of Thrones viewer, waited 2 years for them to come back on the air and give us a new episode and then not be ready to watch it on the opening night, I guess you should turn off the podcast too at this point. However, if you have listened to the podcast, if you have watched season one of Game of Thrones from last night, you can continue listening. Just a few thoughts from me on Game of Thrones. Number one, Danny and John love each other. They are absolutely in love. They got busy in the snow last night. Look, Danny's head over heels with Jon Snow. So much so that she was like, go ahead, hop on my dragon, ride him. Like, that was orgasmic for her. She's watching Jon do all the swooshes and everything, and she kept looking at Jon like, oh, when the dragons touch ground, we are making love in this cold ass snow because I got to be on you. I just happened to be watching a little bit of Anchorman last night, and I was watching the scene where he is talking to Veronica for the first time at the pool party, and he's like, I've got this thing I'm going to say it. I want to throw it out there. I just want to throw it out there and see what happens. I want to be on you. It's the worst line I've ever heard. And it failed miserably. Veronica Cornerstone at that point did not want Ron Burgundy. And I want to be on you wasn't the line that delivered the goods for him. But I kind of felt like Danny was looking at John last night like, I want to be on. And she did. Like, what was the line? Like, he was like, it's cold out here or something like that for a girl from the South. And she's like, well, you better warm your queen up. Like, damn. I say damn because they rode into Winterfell looking gangster. You know, they're riding on their horses looking like they were straight up pimps. Then they rode on the dragons and got naked and did it in the snow. No pun intended. And then Jon Snow finds out that, like, he's with his aunt. And I just don't know what to do with this storyline, because it's not that they've just had sex. Like, everybody wants to do the, ew, he got busy with his family. Honestly, in this show, I don't know that it really matters. But it is a complicated, like, I think his heir to the throne is a bigger deal, is going to be a bigger deal than the fact that they're already related. Because they're in love. They're in love. And look, John can hang out with Jamie and they can talk about it. Go live in Dorne. Like, go, when this thing's all over with, just go back to Dorne. And you can sleep with her and live with her and be married to her. And, like, nobody will care. I don't think the Dothraki care. I think only judgmental people in King's Landing would care that, and maybe some people in the North. I don't know how the North people feel about that. But, like, they're genuinely in love. And I have thought But I've watched that last couple of episodes from season 7 a couple of times, and I didn't always think that those two shared the kind of chemistry that I think the show wanted them to have. Oh, man. Yesterday, they were all kinds of chemistry. So much so that she's snuggled up with him like, warm your queen up. I mean, what? So I don't know where this thing goes next week, but they love each other. And I am such a hopeless romantic. I want those two crazy kids to make it. I want love to win out. Even in this case, if there's incest, I just, you know, like, have you ever seen the movie Lone Star? It was one of Matthew McConaughey's first movies. Came out, I don't know, 96, 97. He plays an older sheriff. He only gets about a couple of minutes of screen time. It's a Chris Cooper movie. And I don't remember the name of the actress that plays his love interest. The whole movie's about the state of Texas. And it kind of, the movie loses a little bit for me because one of the characters in the movie is obsessed with recruiting. But for a person in the movie to be obsessed with recruiting, I could tell they just knew nothing about recruiting. So I always held that against the movie that they tried to have a person who was college football recruiting obsessed. But if you're going to be obsessed, you can't be a caricature of somebody who's obsessed. And they just didn't put enough detail into that role to make it believable for somebody who's actually recruiting obsessed. Nevertheless, at the end of the movie, spoiler alert, the movie's been out 23 years. Forgive me. Chris Cooper finds out that the woman he's in love with is secretly his sister that he never knew about because she's Hispanic and he's white and there had been an affair. And so they find out that they're related. And it's awful. They're like, oh, no. Look, I'm not in that moment. I can't put myself in the shoes of Chris Cooper finding out that he is in love with his sister literally moments after they made love for the first time. All I know is that Danny is his aunt, but she ain't ever been his aunt. And technically, they're like the same age. It's like in You've Got Mail, when Tom Hanks is talking to Meg Ryan, and he's talking about his family being the all-American family, and he's like, this little boy is, what was he, his uncle? Because he was his grandfather's son, and the girl who's, you know, like 8 years old is his sister because that's his dad's daughter. Well, you can say that little boy is your uncle all you want to, but the reality is those are just words. Now, Tom Hanks ain't having a kid or making love to the little boy or the little girl, but, you know, sometimes you can just put labels on things, and I say, don't worry about the labels. I wonder, I don't know how they're going to react to this, but I want them to still be able to be in love. It's going to be really sad when they're not, because they really looked like an in-love couple last night. And, you know, I have a feeling season 2 will do some change. How about Sansa? Sansa's just, she ain't having Danny at all. So that little cat fight thing is going to be interesting to watch the rest of the way. As just to go back to love interest, go Arya. The flirt. She's never had a boyfriend before, but she flirted and handled Gendry in episode 1 like a woman that had 100 boyfriends. She's given Gendry sass. She's giving him like a little cutesy, like she just owned it last night. You could make a case for me last night was the MVP of the episode, if for no other reason than her first interaction with Gendry was just completely gangster. She just was like, Gendry has no chance. I wondered how that would go because once upon a time, Gendry was like, we can stay here and you'll be my lady. And Arya was all about that. And then they haven't seen each other for years and so much has happened. And Arya sees Gendry for the first time. And instead of giving him like the puppy dog, I'm so glad we've been lost. And I'm, you know, she looked at him like, you better grab on a hold on because I ain't a little girl anymore. And I hope before the war is over, this might be illegal for me to say, but I hope Gendry and Arya make it happen. I don't need to see it on screen. I don't need anything illegal. But Arya and Gendry making babies together and having and living happily ever after, I think I want that as much as I want anything. If I have to choose one of the two, Arya and Gendry having little Baratheon babies with Stark blood in them, if I had the choice of that, or Dany and Jon surviving as a couple, I think I'll choose Arya's happiness. Jon can't be happy anyway. He's always got to mope around. Lyanna Mormont. Damn, man. Take it easy on Jon. Jon just tried to save the damn planet. And Lyanna's like, you left the King of the North. You came back with this bitch. Like, hey, little girl. Chill out. She gave it to Jon. Jon didn't know what to say. And so that meant Tyrion had to come in and try to save the day and talk to a room full of people from the North who want to kill him. So it really didn't go well for that whole un-Northern side of the fence. A couple of other things before we go. Cersei had sex with Euron. And it seemed to last about 3 minutes. And then Euron did that thing that guys do. He had sex with her. And he hadn't finished buckling his belt on his pants before he was like, so how do I compare to your dead husband? And notice, Cersei wasn't in the complimenting mood. But she was like, oh, well, Robert was pretty terrible. He could be with 1,000 women up in heaven right now and still not knowing how to please a woman. But then he went for it. Then he was like, well, how do I compare to the Kingslayer? And if you'll notice, Cersei might be trying to kill Euron Greyjoy. And she might be trying to kill Jaime Lannister, which it would appear that she is based on the fact that Bronn's been given a special bow to kill both of her brothers. Cersei did not compliment Euron. Euron wanted to hear you were an awesome lover, and Cersei said Robert was terrible and you're arrogant. And that's it. She said she liked arrogant, but that didn't necessarily mean that he rocked her world. And all I know is that Cersei was back into that glass. If given a choice of Euron Greyjoy or a glass of wine, it was pretty clear in the immediate aftermath of what took place, Cersei preferred the wine to Euron Greyjoy, and Euron doesn't even know it. Euron's walking around, just lost his sister to a raid. He thinks he's got this thing on lockdown, and Cersei is plotting against everybody. And it feels like when this season ends, after last night, I literally don't know how this thing's going to go. Episode one set this thing up really, really well in that I'm pretty sure they're going to defeat the Iceman in a couple of episodes. And I've been thinking that it was going to be the Night's King. But the Battle of Winterfell is in two episodes. It's episode three. Cersei's not coming to the battle. So I have to believe they win the Battle of Winterfell. And then the final episodes are about resolving everything else. You know, winter might be over at that point. But I don't know. I have no idea. The big Battle of Winterfell is in two episodes. They said last night that the Army of the Dead is 24 hours away. So this thing's coming to a head. Cersei's not going to be there. She's got the Golden Company chilling back at King's Landing. So I wonder, I've been thinking that this thing might go the distance, and I don't know. This thing was set up so perfectly because of, as of last night, I don't know who's going to live. I don't know who's going to be happy. I don't know if anybody's going to be happy. Is Sansa going to end up being Cersei 2.0 and she's the one that takes, I don't know. I do know that it was kind of fucked up that Dany felt like she had to tell Sam upon first meeting each other that she killed her family, or his family. The way Dany needed to handle that was to get Sam on a rebound. Like, they needed to part, and then she needed to take a couple of hours, let it breathe, call him back in, and say, Sam, something's been on my mind since we met, and I like you. I like you. John loves you. And I gotta be honest with you. I encountered your brother and your father. I wanted them to live. I gave them an opportunity. They dissed me hardcore. You know, like, had to do it. And I'm sorry. I wish they were here right now. Please forgive me. Like, you know, she ain't about asking for forgiveness, but she just handled the Sam thing wrong. She told Sam right away, and Sam was like, let me find John's ass and tell him you're not the queen. Sam is very pro. John, get your ass on the throne. Take her off. She, deep down, he wants to say, that bitch killed my, but he can't. He can't. First of all, Sam's a gentleman. So Sam will say, the queen. He's going to refer to her as the queen. Maybe the illegitimate queen. Sam ain't a big fan of Danny right now, which makes it odd because John's in total head over heels. Like, Sansa busted that ass last night when she was like, did you bend the knee because you felt like you needed to save the North, or did you bend the knee because you love her? And John didn't exactly give an answer. Anyway, and on that note, that is my breakdown of the spring football of Tiger Woods and Game of Thrones all rolled into one. We'll do this thing again later on in the week. Thank you for listening. Keep listening to all of the podcasts on the Yak. Later.